I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg. She's joined in conversation by style writer Carolyn Zinko. And now join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Diane von Furstenberg and Carolyn Zinko. Diane von Furstenberg first entered the fashion world in 1972 with a suitcase full of jersey dresses. 2 years later, she created the wrap dress, which came to symbolize power and independence for an entire generation of women. By 1976, she had sold over 1 million wrap dresses. After a hiatus from fashion, Diane relaunched the iconic dress that started it all in 1997, reestablishing her company as a global luxury lifestyle brand. DVF is now sold in over 55 countries. Diane von Furstenberg is here tonight with her extraordinary memoir, The Woman I Wanted to Be, in which she shares the inspiring lessons she's learned on the path to becoming a modern icon. The book has received raves from everyone from Gloria Steinem to Sheryl Sandberg. Here tonight in conversation with Diane von Furstenberg is Carolyn Zinko, San Francisco Chronicle Style Section staff writer. Please join me in welcoming Diane von Furstenberg and Carolyn Zinko to the JCCSF.
Well, welcome, everybody. Diane, this has been quite a year for you so far. You have two books. You've got a reality TV show, a museum exhibition in Los Angeles, and lots of philanthropic work. So much going on that I had to have my term paper to keep track of it all, 8 pages of questions. So I hope you don't mind, but I like to be organized. You came to the Bay Area on Wednesday, and you've spoken to the Stanford
Business school.
You spoke with employees at Google earlier today, and now you're here, and everyone's excited. We have a lot of ground to cover, so as Barbara mentioned, one of your two books is a memoir, and we'll get to that. But let's start by talking about your other book and the topic of it, The Journey of a Dress. The exhibition was marking the 40th anniversary of the wrap dress, and that is amazing staying power. I don't think I've ever heard of a dress that people wore 40 years ago with the same panache that they, you know, would today.
So it was very interesting because I had never, even though the wrap dress has paid for all my bills, my children's education, my houses and everything, I kind of took it for granted. And sometimes I would even resent it when it was always Diane von Furstenberg, the wrap dress. And last year, we knew that we were approaching the 40th anniversary, and people in my office say, we have to celebrate it. And I really wasn't sure about it. And then I got convinced. I remember we had a whole meeting, and I just said, but it sounds so old to say that, the 40th anniversary. And someone in the room said, all you have to say is, I was 25 when I created the wrap dress. And I thought, yeah, that looks better. That sounds better. So anyway, so we decided to do the exhibition. Oh, at least I considered doing it. And for some reason, I wanted Los Angeles, because Los Angeles has beautiful light, and it was New York. I'm too much part of the furniture. I didn't think it was that interesting for people. And so I thought, Los Angeles, and I went to see Michael Govan at LACMA, who does such a good job, and we talked, and then I said, don't you have a place around here, something? And then he told me about, it is on the LACMA, campus. And but it used to be an old department store called the Bullocks Wilshire. And so Bullocks Wilshire, remember that? And it is going to be transformed in a few months, and it's going to become after that the Museum of the Academy, of the Film Academy, the Oscar. So I thought, a department store, LACMA, and glamour of Hollywood, that sounds like a good thing. And so I went to see it, and then we decided to do it. And it was in terrible condition, so we completely redid it. And there was a timeline, so we divided the exhibition into three parts. One is the timeline. You walk into this corridor, and you see all the timeline, you know, the first letter from Diana Vreeland, Sybil Shepherd in The Taxi Driver, and then Michelle Obama and Madonna, and it goes on and on.
All the people wearing the dress,
yes,
over time.
And then you walk into this huge room, I mean, bigger than this, and I thought to do these, I wanted an army of wrap dresses. You know, like the Chinese warriors, you know the answer. And I wanted that, and then the third part was all art, because after all, it's in a museum, and because I have known artists all through my life, and the pose for them and be painted by them, that was the art part. And so that's basically what we wanted, but I needed somebody fresh, with a fresh eye, to actually curate it, because for me, there's, you know, my archive is just a bunch of old dresses. And I found a very interesting, very talented young man in London who was at the time creative director of Bally from Switzerland. And he was leaving and he was looking for something to do. And I said, you know, I don't have a job, but I may have a project. And then come to my archive in Connecticut. So he came. And he spent a week in the archives, and then came up with how he wanted to do it. But I said, you are allowed to make new dresses. You're allowed to take old prints and reissue them and change the scale and everything like that. So he was allowed to do that. And he did such a great job because everything, it was wonderful because you saw the 1974, the original T72, next to new anniversary dresses. And it was so timeless. And I ended up hiring him, actually. I ended up hiring him. And now he runs my design studio. So it's very exciting. But anyway, this exhibition was wildly successful. It got extended until May 1st. Hundreds of thousands of people saw it. Lots of people posted, Instagram, blah, blah. But the most important thing it did is that the effect it had on me. It really showed me, you know, it's like the body of my work like that. And it just was very, very good for me to see it and for understand really what the power of that dress and the impact it had. And so I stopped looking at it like what it had done for me, but started looking at it what it had done for others. And at this point, the dress is bigger than me. I think the dress, I'm like the conduit for the dress.
Well, you've called it sort of a sociological phenomenon.
Well, yeah, which was funny because at the time when I started, I my goal then was just to be financially independent. So I wasn't trying to make a fashion statement. I just made little easy dresses that would be both proper and chic and sexy and easy and not too expensive and blah, blah, blah. But I ended up 40 years later, I did more than the fashion statement. I did the sociological statement. So in other words, so that exhibition, very important. So the book came out also 2 weeks ago, just this week here, actually. And it's published by Rizzoli, and it's exact copy of the exhibition. And the memoir, which I finished just a few 2 months ago, the memoir ends the day of the exhibition. So that day that I was driving my little rental car, that morning before starting the press conference at the exhibition, and I saw the big building and all my the pictures of Warhol of me and everything in there, and I said, okay, somebody can smash into my car. Everything is there. And so it ended up being important.
So when you created the wrap dress, you were actually a princess at that time.
Yeah, I had married a prince.
Why did you need a day job?
Well, because I wanted to be independent. It was very, very important for me to be independent. For many reasons. Maybe I should talk about my mother. Why, you know, maybe because that explains why I wanted to be independent, or you're going to talk about that later?
We're going to...
I wanted to be... I wanted to be independent, and that's it.
So yesterday at Stanford, you spoke to some business students, 500 business students, and the chat was arranged by a female group called Stanford Women in Business. They are starting their own careers, and you told them basically what's on page 149 of the book, which I will read now. Listen, always listen. Most people at the beginning of their lives don't know what they want to be unless you have a real vocation like a pianist or a doctor. So it's very important to listen. Sometimes there are doors that will open and you think it is not an important door, and yet it is. So it's important to be curious and pay attention, because sometimes you learn and don't even know you're learning. This, I think, you brought this up yesterday because it related to a period in your life in your early 20s when you went to Italy.
Yes.
To visit textile mills run by Angelo Ferretti. What did you absorb there without really knowing it, and how did it help with the wrap dress?
When I was a young girl, I did not know what I wanted to do, but I did know the woman I wanted to be. I wanted to be a woman who was independent, who would drive her own bus, who was in charge of her life. And so when I had an opportunity, this Italian man who had an industrialist, he had a printing plant, and he said, come and see what I do and learn what I'm doing. And so I went, and I learned everything about printing. And then next to it, he bought another factory, and he invented this incredible jersey fabric, because he bought the factory, and there were machines. He bought the building, and in the building, there were still machines to make make stockings, because the pantyhose had just existed. And so he looked at these machines and said, what can I use this machine for? And so he talked to yarn companies, DuPont and Snievi Scosa, whatever. And he invented this jersey fabric to make very elegant and beautiful fabric that he would make T-shirts, elegant T-shirts. Now, a T-shirt today seems like an obvious thing. At the time, only sailors wear T-shirts. But in Saint-Tropez, people started to wear T-shirts with an anchor called Saint-Tropez. And so anyway, so I learned everything with him also about making this interesting fabric. And then he had another factory, which he bought while I was there, where they used to make nightgowns. But the reason he bought it is because they had very fine needles. So there was a printing plant, a knitting plant, and a factory to sew. And then I went to visit Egon for just a month in New York, my boyfriend, who I had met at university. And when I went there to New York, I loved New York. It was so exciting. It was so fun. And I saw another kind of fashion than was in Europe. It was much more industrialized, and there were lots of department stores. And I saw designers like Giorgio Santangelo and Holsten and Stephen Burrows, and they used to do all these very, you know, extravagant clothes in Jersey. So when I went back to the factory, all of a sudden I looked at those factories in a way that, there may be something that I can use here. And I asked him if I could make a few samples, and I did, and voila.
Yeah, and what was really...
And that was my door.
Right, and what was really
that
shocking...
That was my door.
What was shocking to the kids at the business school yesterday is that you have this built this great company, but you never had a business plan. You were an entrepreneur without a business plan, without a solid
That's
financial structure.
That's nothing to be proud
right?
of.
But you had, yeah, you had a great product.
Yes, and at the end, it's really the product that drives. And so I was very young. I didn't really know what I was doing, and it went very, very fast. And I lived an American dream at the age of 25, and that was pretty amazing. I mean, now it's very, in San Francisco and the Bay Area, it's so common to be a billionaire at 25. But at the time, to be successful that young was pretty rare.
Well, speaking of your product, can we have a show of hands? How many people are wearing a wrap dress tonight? Okay, I think that's like a quarter or maybe a third of the audience. Good job.
But the thing that's amazing about the dress is that it has hit so many generations. Because if I was 25, my mother was 47, and there was even older than my mother who would wear it. And then after that came my daughter's generation, and now my granddaughter's generation. It's pretty amazing. And also with the exhibition, I created some completely new wraps, you know, half woven, half knit, long, short, rompers. I redid the jumpsuit. So I realized that, you know, it's endless what I can do with a wrap dress, even if shoulder pads would come back to the dynasty years.
Well, for the sake of chronological order, let's move to your memoir. It's called, as you said, The Woman I Wanted to Be. And in this book, which I enjoyed very much, you're very, very open about every facet of your life, about your mother's terrible ordeal at Auschwitz, your childhood, your love life, and an aside to the audience, boy, is that juicy. And also all your business ups and downs. I actually didn't know this. You are nearly bankrupt at least once. But the book talks a lot about your mother, so I thought it'd be interesting to know, why did you write the book right now and why focus on your mom so much?
Well, I wrote the book because my mother passed away 14 years ago, and I, you know, when your mother goes, you let her strengths come out, you know, because before that you kind of protect yourself a little. And I realized how... So I started to... My mother was, at the age of 22, she was arrested in Belgium. She was doing resistance. And she was arrested, and she went to Auschwitz, Ravensbrück, and Kastel-Neustadt. Three camps for 13 months when she... It was one day the Germans had gone, then a Russian came, that wasn't much better, and then finally the American came. She weighed 49 pounds. And so she wasn't supposed to live, but she did live. And it's very interesting because we found a thing that she filled when the Americans came. She was in the hospital, and then in order to go home, you had to fill, you know, where you come from and this and that. And it said, state of health, and she wrote, excellent health. She was 49 pounds, and she could barely move. So she came back, she went back, and her parents couldn't believe that she was alive. Her mother fed her very little, you know, every 10 minutes, a tiny little bit of food. So that, and she said that she felt like it was like a balloon, like that. 6 months later, her fiancé, who had spent the last 2 or 3 years in Switzerland, came back. They got married, and the doctor said, you absolutely cannot have a child, at least for 3 years. because your body won't be able to handle it, and the child may not be normal. So sure enough, 9 months later, I was born. And I was not normal.
You're listening to fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg, whose new memoir is The Woman I Wanted to Be. She's joined in conversation by Carolyn Zinko on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
But my mother, I am born on New Year's Eve, and my mother, every birthday, she would write to me, and she always said to me, God save me so that I can give you life. And by giving you life, you gave my life back. And you are my torch of freedom. So this is what she told, put in my hands as a little child, that I was her torch of freedom. So writing about that and reading about that, I realized how clearly the person that I became is so much to do with my mother and what an impact she had on me to be independent, to be, you know, a survivor, to be all the things that I was. And in many ways, I was the revenge of my mother. And I married a German prince. He was half Italian, though.
I found some things very surprising in this book, and I think a lot of people who are going to read the book may feel the same way. Here's one thing, for example. So you, Diane von Furstenberg, who joins the club of people who have abbreviations for names, DVF, like J-Lo. You, who are so famous, gorgeous, wealthy, jet-setting, probably has Anna Wintour on speed dial. You wake up some mornings and you feel like a loser. Really?
I say that a lot. I say, yeah, I do, and I do. I do. I mean, there are moments that I just feel like a loser because I try so hard and I don't always see results and sometimes I have doubts. But I ask my husband, who's a very successful man, and he often feels like a loser too. I think that, and so does Anna Wintour, by the way. So I think that feeling like a loser is giving you also fuel to succeed.
So you're in a very tough industry. The industry is based on how people look. But in your book, you say you have considered plastic surgery, but you have also rejected it. So if I could read from page 133 and 134, you say, confidence makes us beautiful, and it comes from accepting yourself. The moment you accept yourself, it makes everything better. I certainly don't like to see my face aging in photographs, but I know if I wait 10 years, I will love those pictures. So I accept my image as who I am. Why have I not clipped the bits of surplus skin on my eyelids? I am not sure. But probably because I am afraid of freezing time, of not recognizing myself in the mirror, the image I have been so friendly with. My image is who I am. And even if I don't always love it, I am intrigued by it, and I find the changes interesting. I think
the lighting, I worry about the lighting.
Well, I have to say, so I was reading
smile
the book.
Smile aloud and accept yourself.
Well, so I guess it struck me very personally, especially this year, because I just turned 50.
She turned 50.
I just turned 50. And
she's pretty hot, right?
And I had, well, I had a minor freak out, as my colleagues in the audience will tell you. And when I read this passage, it really made me smile and feel a lot better.
Good.
So, how did you become so secure?
I am not. I mean, no, I am. In a, no, I guess I am. I don't know. I mean, listen, if you don't accept yourself, then who else will? You know, it's just... well, listen, you know what? I said it all in the book. Read the book. I signed it. I don't think I could say it any better.
Yeah. So, if, to sort of try to summarize extremely briefly, you created the wrap dress to be independent and self-sufficient. The dress struck a nerve with the public. You were a huge success based on your own intuition and this idea. You had peaks and valleys. After the wrap dress became a huge sensation, then the market got oversaturated because you didn't diversify. You just had one product and everybody had one.
Oh, more than one.
Right. But you also did a makeup line. You sold clothing called Silk Assets on QVC.
That's mentioned later. Yeah.
Much later. On HSN also?
Also.
Okay. And then in the late 1990s, we saw the return of the wrap dress. And you mentioned in this book, this was due in part to the support of Rosemary Bravo, who then was Saks Fifth Avenue president. But a lot of people in the Bay Area will remember her from iMagnon.
That's right. That's right.
So, but why do you think the wrap dress was such a hit again?
I don't know. I the reason I went back to it is also because I started to see young hip girls buying it in vintage shops, which is what happens over and over again. And so I started again 15 years ago, and that was my comeback kid. And the second time around, it wasn't really about being independent, because I had become independent. It was more about showing myself in the world that it hadn't been an accident the first time around. And I proved my point. And now I'm starting a third period, which is new era, which is because I am in the fall of my life, hopefully early fall. And so it's a reflecting time. And also recent, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, I went a little bit off brand and I lost confidence in the business. I was, you know, very concerned about China and I wasn't paying attention. And so I explained that also. And so that's why the last 2 years, the last year and a half, I really wanted to carve into the DNA. That's why the exhibition, that's why the books and everything was also super useful to me. And now I know what the brand stands for, and now it's about, you know, making sure that it can last after me, and it's developing accessories and making sure that the brand is all about solution-driven, that I am the friend in the closet for when you wake up in the morning and your eyes are swollen and you don't feel good. What do I wear? Go for the friend.
So your wrap dress is a hit, and it's hip and happening, but you are also hip to technology because you've got a partnership with Google in Google Glass. What happened at Google today?
Oh, I spoke at Google, but I saw my friend, the co-founder, Sergey Brin, and my whole story with Google was completely accidental, really, that I knew the boys, as they call them. I had spoken there in 2005. And that summer in Sun Valley, I saw Sergey, and he was hiding behind a tree. And he had this weird thing, and he said, come, I show you. And so he showed me they weren't really glasses, they were just bands, and he had the thing. And he showed me what it is, and so we started to talk, and I said, Sergey, have you ever been to a fashion show? He said, no. I said, you should come. You should come. In September, it's Fashion Week. You should come to my fashion show. Okay, goodbye, goodbye. That's over. Then about 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, he calls me, and he said, hi, it's Sergey. How about putting the Google Glass on the show? And I thought, oh, I didn't even understand what he said, but I said, sure, of course. And and then we but it was very secret because nobody had seen Google Glass, and so I guess that they were having a marketing meeting, and how can we show it in a way that's a little bit more sexy? After all, it's dry technology and this and that. And somebody must have said the word fashion. He said, oh, I have a friend who is a fashion designer. And so one thing to the next. So it's all very secret. We had actually the models wear the Google Glass on the show, not just to show it to the public, it had never been seen before, but they were, as they were walking the runway, they were filming. And so that, and Sergey said, we'll make a film because no one has ever seen how it feels to be walking, right? I mean, anyway, so we did that, and it was great. I mean, Google Glass showed everything. We made the movie. 2 million people saw it. It was in the front news of, you know, everywhere. And there I was forever in history associated with Google.
And you're, so you know a lot of these people. You know Sergey, you know Larry, you know Mark Zuckerberg. What do you make of all these young people?
Well, they're all nerds, really. but somehow they may. I mean, they're incredible. I mean, I think that the Google guys. I mean, they are like Julius Caesar in steroids, right? I mean, they completely invaded the planet. It's pretty amazing.
Well, let's move a little bit to the away from the business side.
I told him that this afternoon, by the way.
Oh, okay, good. So let's move a little bit to your personal life. There were some years when you took a break from the wrap dress, and during those years you were fairly busy with your love life, and people like hearing about other people's love lives a little bit, and you're pretty open in your book. So you said you had a series of romantic relationships with a variety of people, including a fling with Richard Gere. Inquiring minds want to know, what was he like?
He was boring.
No! Okay, well, then I'm going to assume
that... He would kill me if I said that, but he was boring.
Well,
he was cute. Yeah. This was Richard Gere at American Gigolo time.
Wow.
At that time. Not Richard Gere now.
Okay. So I guess we're going to assume the opposite of Barry Diller, who's your husband, a Hollywood and media executive.
And who is not dull.
He's not dull. That's why you're together with him. You dated him off and on for many years, something like 25, 29
No,
years.
We fell in love in 1975, okay. Which is 39 years ago. We fell madly in love, and it was very passionate, and we were together for 5 years.
Okay.
And then I went on.
Okay.
And I went on for a while, and then, but he was always this presence, you know, that made always the other men very jealous. And then 26 years later, I married him. I married him for his 59th birthday.
Wow.
That was the present.
It was, you write in the book that it was during your 30s and 40s that you spent a lot of time in these relationships. Not all of them turned out well, and you learned a lot about yourself. And I'm particularly interested in what you wrote on page 82. Looking back, I smile at the ways I tailored my personality to merge with those of different men at different times in my life. I think most women consciously change their stripes, or at least modify them in their relationships with men, especially during the delicious period of seduction. They become instant football lovers, or sailing enthusiasts, or political junkies, then taper back to their own personalities when the relationship is either cemented or over. No one I know, however, went to the lengths that I did. You had a relationship with someone named Paulo.
Brazilian
from
man.
From Brazil. And you wore sarongs.
Jungle man.
You wore a lot
of... I met him in Bali in a bamboo house.
And then...
He hadn't worn shoes in 10 years.
And then you took up with an Italian journalist with whom you lived in Paris and had an intellectual life wearing wool skirts, buttoned-up sweaters, and flats because he did not like the sexy clothes you were designing. But you said on page 85, "Looking back, I realize how many things I let go from my relationship with him. He wanted me to give up my personality and my success, and I actually did it with enthusiasm. My children used to say, 'Mommy has zero personality.' I was seduced by the role I was embracing of the devoted artist's woman." So what you're independent and strong and self-confident.
I know, but it was a fantasy. I mean, we all have the fantasy of being this submissive muse. And it was fun. It was nice for a while until it wasn't so nice anymore. And then I went off. But we had a good time. I mean, it was fine. We spent 4.5 years together. My slot was usually 4.5 years. It was always 2 years to go up and 2 years to go down.
Oh, my God. Well, let's move from the memoir now, because you have the TV show, a new TV show on E! Called House of DVF. It's on Sunday nights at 10 o'clock. And I believe we have a clip of that, which we'd like to see.
Amanda, come on. How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm literally freaking out, like shaking. My heart is beating. I think my vision is like going blurry.
Bronson came to see me and he said, "Wow, you know, I'm a little nervous. How is it going?"
At times, there's like a little bit of tension.
What goes on?
Well, I got in like a little argument with Brittany today. She's trying to say little things to put herself here and put the others below. And I don't think that's right. She likes to be the boss and like take charge of the situation. And I've kind of just let her, but I'm at the point where I like feel like I'm getting emotional. I don't usually.
No, but that's okay.
Thank you.
You know, when I was young, I didn't want to be taken advantage of. As I get more confident and less insecure, I realize that you have to stand for who you are.
Yeah.
It's important, especially in the fashion industry, to actually forget about the personality of the people you're working with. Just get the job done.
So why are you doing this show?
So it's very interesting.
I mean, not that you shouldn't.
Because I usually don't like those kinds of shows because they objectify the women. But I am interested in the genre, and I'm interested because I have granddaughters who are glued to television. And I just say, why are you looking at it, watching that? So many people came to me with ideas, and none of them I liked. And then we came up with the idea of bringing 8 girls into the company, and they would learn everything from designing to merchandising to retail to putting an event together and all of that. And then one of them would become a brand ambassador and would get a contract for a year and would travel the world representing the brand. And so I did it. And so it is fun. It is informative. It's a little bit catty at times because the producer make it happen. But I managed to pass on some very empowering messages, and so I completely stand by it. And it's fun. You could see, if you haven't seen the first episode, I'm sure you can find them online, but episode 4 will be on Sunday at 10 o'clock.
Now, what we saw, we saw a little bit of crying just on this clip, but there is a lot of crying on this show. Are you a big meanie? What's going on?
No, but it was very emotional for these girls. It was, and they were
young.
And they were wonderful girls. I mean, they are wonderful girls. The youngest one was 19, and she's already, actually, she is gone because the episode before she was let go. But actually, I liked her so much that she now she started yesterday to work in one of my shops. So I have really grown to love these girls, and not the first two. I mean, the first two that The first two that left were a little weirdos, but but I really have grown to like all of those girls, and they stay very close to me. One of them actually is from the Bay Area, Brittany, and she's in the room somewhere.
I want to see her afterwards. If you can stay, I would love to talk to you.
But you cannot, as she cannot tell you who wins. She's just one of the candidates.
She's bound to secrecy.
Right.
Okay, well, we won't make anything bad happen for her or the show.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg, whose new memoir is The Woman I Wanted to Be. She's joined in conversation by Carolyn Zinko. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Speaking of TV shows, I don't know if any of you guys watched The Colbert Report, but you were on The Colbert Report on November 11th. If you haven't seen it, go online and watch it, because, you know, he's like very irreverent and strange and everything. But you killed it. You were awesome. And there is...
I didn't know. I was terrified. I didn't know, because I don't really get, you know, it's like... But I'm glad I did well.
You did great. You did great. And I wish I could remember the joke, but there's a joke about Viagra, and she brings up Viagra, and it just totally embarrassed him. It's hilarious. So now you've seen the show Inside the Actor's Studio with James
yes.
Lipton. Okay, so I thought maybe we could have a series of rapid-fire questions.
Okay.
And then you just give, you know...
Quick answers.
Super short answers, or long if you wish.
Okay.
It's up to you. What color looks good on everybody?
What color looks good on everybody? The color they like.
What book is the latest on your iPad or Kindle?
I just finished the last biography on Chanel, and I started the one on Elsa Schiaparelli.
Okay. What is your favorite indulgence?
Dark chocolate.
Mm.
I am Belgian, after all.
What have you lost that you wish you still had?
Oh, a certain bracelet.
What is your favorite possession?
My children. Aww. But I don't possess them.
Right. If you weren't you, who would you want to be?
Ooh. Ooh. Well, somebody who did real good, like maybe Leonardo da Vinci or somebody like that. Marlene Dietrich, I wouldn't mind that either.
Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
How do you spoil your grandkids?
I don't spoil them.
You don't?
No, I don't think... Well, I don't think so. No, I don't spoil. I mean, spoil is such an ugly word. I mean, it means to ruin them. I hope I don't ruin them. I didn't tell you they are not spoiled, but I mean, I don't spoil them.
On the entire planet, where is your favorite place to hike?
Oh, Bhutan.
Wow. Where are you spending Thanksgiving?
My God, I am leaving tonight, and I'm going to East Indonesia.
Wow.
Where our boat is waiting for us, and where I will be hiking.
Awesome. Now, we haven't...
It's very glamorous, thank you.
Yeah.
But it's also a very long trip.
That's true. We haven't talked about your philanthropy. Is there something that you would like to say about that, or your work with CFDA, like... Which designers you feel are the most promising?
Okay, so the roles other than a designer, I am president of the Council of Fashion Designers of America, which means I am the Jewish mother of all designers. And we do a lot of good work there. I am very involved and on the board of Vital Voices, which is an organization that empowers women that was founded by Hillary Clinton when she was first lady. I have been very involved in making the High Line happen, which is this elevated railway. My husband and I just announced that we are turning another pier on the West Side River, and we are going to turn it into another park, which will have open air performances. But more important than anything, I think that is important for if you have any success or if you have any voice at all, to remember that you should use your voice. It is your duty, but it's also your privilege to use your voice for people who have no voice.
Great. Well, I know that Barbara and others have some microphones, and I think there's a chance for questions and answers right now.
Okay. Thank you so much. I just had a quick question. I had seen a video of you putting a coin in a shoe before your fashion shows, and I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that tradition.
Yes, my father, who was a very lucky man, you'll read in the book that he actually made his first money. Well, you'll read it in the book anyway. There's a whole idea. And then I have these gold coins that he had during the war. And every fashion show, when I'm very nervous, I put the coin, I tape it inside my shoe so I can walk on it, and it brings me good luck.
I actually have two very quick questions. You're such an inspiration to so many people, and you're the epitome of success. Can you explain the title, The Woman I Wanted to Be?
Oh, I became that woman very early. So, it's because I always say I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew the woman I wanted to be. And the woman I wanted to be was independent and all of that. And I became it very early.
And then you've talked about diversifying some, your company some. When will there be a men's line?
Sergey asked me the same thing today. So, I don't know, for maybe one day, I'll be doing surfing trunks and shirts.
The next question's right here in the middle.
Oh, hi. This isn't actually really a question. I just wanted to tell you that when I was in third grade, I had one of your Barbie dolls, and I didn't really know very much about it, so I wrote a report on it, and I made a wrap dress. And I came to class, and all the other kids were doing reports on, Paul Revere and George Lucas. And so my teacher pointed out early on to very many of the other teachers that I was that kid. So I just want to thank you for that, and you're such an inspiration.
Oh, it was a good thing.
Oh, yeah, I made a timeline. Okay. I had a Barbie doll. It was great.
Yeah. How did it come to be that you were a subject of an Andy Warhol painting?
Oh, you have to understand, Andy Warhol was just the guy hanging around. I mean, he wasn't the Andy Warhol who sells for so much. And he said, oh, gee, I'd like to do your Polaroid. And he took a Polaroid, but he needed a white wall. And I didn't have any white wall except in the kitchen. So that's why I carried the wall was very small. That's why I did like that with my arm. That was the first time he painted me. And then he painted me again in the 80s. But I mean, at the time, it wasn't that special, really. But that's what happened with all the contemporaries. They're just your friends, and then you wait a few years, and they become very famous.
Hi, Diane. What a pleasure it is to finally get to meet you. I purchased this skirt when I was 22 years old. It has the bunny print on it.
The Playboy bunny.
That's correct.
I was looking for that.
Oh, here you... I've been looking for you.
I was looking for that print. I did that for Playboy. That's
yes, nice. And I was 22. I saved up all of my rubles. I was a student over at Cal. So I'm a little disappointed you were at Stanford today, but that's okay. And my 35-year-old self now thanks my 22-year-old self for purchasing this skirt that, A, it still fits me, and B, that has transcended over, you know, over a decade, and it's still relevant, and it's still something that, you know, can be worn. How do you do that? What do you do to stay relevant?
I don't know. My clothes don't age very well, or don't age, or whatever. I mean, and you say you can sell them on eBay for what you paid for 20 years ago, so or more. I don't know. I like timeless things, I guess, and it's all about glorifying the woman, and it's about using fabrics that feel good and mold you in the right way. I don't know. I mean, I can't. I don't know that. But it's nice to be told you're an old, relevant woman. I tell my husband all the time, I said, we are an old, relevant couple.
As an entrepreneur in the fashion world now, any advice? What's maybe two tips for us?
Well, the only advice that I will tell you is the most important relationship in life is the one you have with yourself. That's all you need to know. But it's a lot of work.
Hi. I read one of your books, I think maybe 10, 15 years ago. It was an aqua-covered book.
Yes.
And I found it very empowering. I've been involved with a lot of women's movements.
Right.
And I don't think you've ever said this directly, but would you consider yourself a feminist?
Totally. I am a... totally. I am a feminist with many, many M's. And I don't understand why people don't like the word feminist, because you can be feminist and feminine.
Hi, thanks again for coming. I wanted to know, are either of your children interested in your business and inheriting your business or working in it?
Well, I have a granddaughter who would like, yeah, who probably is very interested. When she was 9 years old, she said, Dee, when I take over your business, do I have to call it Diane von Furstenberg? Or can I call it Talita von Furstenberg? And I didn't answer right away. She said, no, it's okay, I'll take it as it is.
I'm loving this evening. I'm just curious, when you were talking about being a fighter for some causes where there's no voice, I'm a fashion designer. I design jewelry. And a couple of years ago, I developed a pendant for elephants that gave back 100% to the David Wildlife Trust. And as I'm sitting here and being so inspired, I was thinking how wonderful it would be to create a wrap dress with elephants on it and to give back to the trust.
Yes, and Hillary Clinton would be very happy. And I may very well do that. I will tell her you suggested it.
So you just described yourself as a feminist and feminine and said that it's possible to be both. For those of us in the room who work in very male-dominated industries, what advice would you give us for how we can achieve success?
Like what industry?
I work in finance.
Okay.
How can we achieve success and stay feminine?
You know, I just spoke to a huge, about 900 bankers of J.P. Morgan recently, and I noticed they don't dress the same as they dressed 15 years ago. They're much more. And she asked me, one of the girls said, you know, if I walk in a room with all these men, you know, how do I impress them? And I said, legs. But at the end, it's the brain. And I think that you should not... It's just a matter... You don't want to be aggressively... I mean, you don't want to be objectified. So you want to look proper and... but seductive.
I'm going to... Because I'm holding the microphone, ask a question. I understand you've done some work recently restoring the synagogue in Venice, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, I haven't. I get more credit than I deserve. I met a friend who is in charge of that, and I introduced him to people to
And he showed me, I went to visit the ghetto and the three synagogues, a very small one next to the other, and they are restoring it, and so I'm getting people together to raise the money and to do that.
I would love to hear, what is your definition of community?
Of community? What a wonderful question. I've never... Community. I think two people... I mean, to get people together is a community. I don't know. I think the planet should be a community. So I have not been part of a particular community because I don't like clubs and I don't like to be necessarily associated. But you say it with such a beautiful accent. That you make it sound super interesting.
Hi. So tonight I'm actually here with my mom, who I started borrowing her wrap dress as the first thing I borrowed from her closet. But throughout the book, you talk about each chapter really in the book is a segment or chapter of your life, and you talk about what really inspires you in that time, whether it's Bali or 70s in New York, so today here in San Francisco or producing this book, what do you wake up and feel excited about?
Well, I mean, I've been on such a crazy tour so that I don't have the luxury of waking up and thinking what inspires me. I just have to go to the next appointment to talk about myself, which is not inspiring. But what do I like about San Francisco? The eucalyptus everywhere smells like eucalyptus. I love that. That's what struck me today.
So thanks so much to all of you for coming tonight. Mostly thanks to you, Diane Van Furstenberg. Thank you, Carolyn.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was fashion designer Diane Van Furstenberg, whose new memoir is The Woman I Wanted to Be. She was joined in conversation by Carolyn Zinko. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Maya Finley. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.